This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Uhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We could see that we will come to the middle of this year when we issue our annual report and find we are off target. And indeed, we are. But the COVID situation is threatening to blow us completely off course.
That's Winnie Bainimi, Executive Director of UNAIDS and the struggle on fighting AIDS around the world. Details coming up also. Satellite images suggest Ethiopia has started filling the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And the U.S. government backs down on restrictions for foreign students. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. First, our top story. Satellite images suggest Ethiopia has started filling the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam despite ongoing tensions with Egypt and Sudan over Africa's largest hydroelectric project. Ethiopia, where the Blue Nile emanates, denies that it has already begun the work, but its prime minister says his country will still go ahead with a planned schedule to fill the dam this month. Fresh talks between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt, which lasted 11 days and included 11 observers and other experts, ended Monday without a breakthrough deal. VOA Salem Solomon looks at what could happen next and has the details.
New images captured in the last week by the European Space Agency's Sentinel-1 satellite show that Ethiopia may have started filling its massive Nile River dam as tensions over the project continue. Ethiopia denied the assertion, but maintains the country's position that it is still on track to begin the multi-year process of filling the dam later this month. The $4.5 billion dam has been under construction for 9 years, and once operational, will be the largest hydroelectric power plant on the African continent, capable of producing 6.4 gigawatts of power. But the project has generated opposition from fellow Nile River countries, Egypt and Sudan, who fear it will affect their access to fresh water. International Crisis Group analyst William Davidson told the Associated Press that the water seen in the images from July 9 might be a result of rainy season overflow rather than a move by the government. Ethiopia reported that water levels are at record highs.
This year is an opportune time to begin impounding water in the Gerd Reservoir. Currently, both the Blue Nile and the White Nile have above normal flow. Lake Victoria is at a record high level. The highest one dam is also at its full supply level of 182 meters above sea level, which is a record high for the past 40 years or four decades.
That was Taye Azgasselassie, ambassador and permanent representative of Ethiopia to the United Nations, speaking during a recent presentation of the three countries at the Security Council. According to reports on Tuesday, talks hosted by the Africa Union between the three nations failed to reach a consensus as Ethiopia moves forward with its intentions. On Monday, the Egyptian Irrigation Ministry confirmed that the three countries will submit a report, with South Africa President Cyril Ramaphosa as a mediator. Speaking to local television, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Egypt said the desired goal is to always reach an agreement. Egypt relies on the Nile for 90% of its freshwater needs.
Certainly, this is an issue that has a very severe consequence on the livelihoods and on the future and the interests of Egypt. And we will do everything possible to preserve our interests, as would any state.
Representatives from all three countries made their case in a virtual session before the UN Security Council in June. While the sides agree on many of the main issues, disagreement remains over how to fill the 70 billion cubic meter dam.
While we recognize the importance of this project to the developmental objectives of the Ethiopian people, a goal that we certainly share and support, it is essential to realize that this megadam, which is Africa's largest hydropower facility, potentially threatens the welfare, the well-being, and the existence of millions of Egyptians and Sudanese citizens.
The contentious negotiations date back to the beginning of the project and have included several mediators. In January 2020, all sides met in Washington, D.C. for talks mediated by the U.S. Treasury Department and the World Bank. The parties appeared close to a technical agreement at the time, but negotiations hit a standstill more recently over whether the agreement will be legally binding under international law. Egypt and Sudan believe Ethiopia should not move forward with filling the dam until an agreement is signed.
Sudan strongly believes that reaching an agreement on the guidelines and principles before the commencement of the filling of the GERD is extremely necessary for the three countries to avoid putting millions of lives and communities at great risk. Any decision on the timing and the filling of the GERD has to be agreed upon.
That was Omar Mohamed Ahmed Siddig, the permanent representative of Sudan to the United Nations. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed stressed that it's not a question of if the dam will be filled, but simply how it will proceed. Abiy believes the future of the country is intertwined with the future of the GERD project. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
South Africa is registering an average of 12,000 new COVID-19 infections every day. The majority are being recorded in the province. That's the country's financial hub, Gauteng, which is also home to its biggest city, Johannesburg. There's a big shortage of hospital beds and healthcare workers in the region. Critics claim that Gauteng's provincial government will cost lives by mismanaging the coronavirus crisis. Darren Taylor has the story.
Scientists expect the pandemic to begin to peak in Gauteng in late August. Modeling says there'll be a shortage of almost 7,000 critical care beds and 1,800 intensive care unit nurses. The provincial government expects to need 25,000 general ward beds for sick coronavirus patients, but only has space now for less than 7,000. Professor Alex van den Heever of Wits University's School of Governance says Gauteng's in big trouble because authorities haven't prepared field hospitals.
Unfortunately, the NASREC facility that's been created doesn't really have functional beds, and they don't have an oxygen supply. I know that there is an urgent process underway to try and service them, to make them available as potential hospital beds, but you also need to have worked out a personnel strategy as well.
Health economists say Johannesburg alone will soon need more than 3,000 nurses. They are currently less than 800. Gauteng Province's Health Minister Bandile Masuku says his department will recruit as many extra healthcare workers as soon as possible. But van den Heever asks why this wasn't done months ago.
It's unclear to me why we are on the back foot at this stage. I mean, there is constant reference to having been expecting this.
Even if authorities manage to employ a lot of new nurses, van den Heever says the recruits won't be familiar with the equipment and processes needed to treat COVID-19 patients.
So ventilators require trained staff, so you do need trained nurses as well. It's unclear how that is going to be organized. In other countries, they have attempted to achieve this objective by restructuring, having lesser trained people in the more routine tasks that nurses would carry out, and then free up the more highly trained nurses for this type of work.
The academic describes Gauteng's treatment strategies as chaotic.
The steep rise that we've seen is much steeper and much faster than anybody's expected, and therefore it's shocked the system. But the beds at least should have been in place.
Masuku responds by calling van den Heever a so-called professor.
People want to come across as experts on fields that they are not. I feel that arguing with people like him, who are almost like hired guns, you don't know what is the mandate, and also people who've got...
The minister says his department hasn't managed to get field hospitals operational yet because it struggled to source equipment. He, however, denies that the provincial government's plans to combat COVID-19 have been poor.
Our strategy has been quite focused, and there is a litany of evidence, even in the social media, in the media, on the work that we've done, focusing on hotspots, starting from when we started our mass testing and screening in Alexander.
Masuku says he'll ask private hospitals to provide additional beds. Van den Heever says this isn't feasible.
The private sector itself is going to run short of beds because medical scheme patients, COVID patients, are increasing all the time in the private sector, And so their bed capacity is also under huge pressure.
Van den Heuver says if new infections increase at their current rate, the system will be overwhelmed and many lives that should have been saved will be lost. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
At least five Tunisian parties say they plan to launch a vote of no confidence in the Speaker of Parliament, Raked Ghannouchi, the leader of the moderate Islamist Ennahda Party. The Free Constitutional Party, led by Abir Moussi, a supporter of former President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who was overthrown by the 2011 revolution, has campaigned to oust Ghannouchi for weeks. Pressure on the government has also mounted with calls for the resignation of Prime Minister Elias Fafaf over an alleged conflict of interest. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
We have a serious political crisis in Tunisia. The biggest losers are the Tunisian people because, like in the U.S., parliamentary infighting can paralyze the legislature and the executive. And the legislature, instead of being focused on Tunisia's economic crisis, is fighting with itself. The party that you mentioned, Moussi's party, called for the speaker's ouster for many months now and wants to classify his party as a terrorist organization, which is hardly a winning move within a parliament. Now, that said, there's a reasonably good chance that this government will fall and that we'll have new elections if things don't move forward. What they're going for is a vote of no confidence. And the parties that are voting for no confidence have about 90 votes. And Moussi, the woman you mentioned's party, has another 16. So they need 109 votes, and they're not too far off from what they would need to bring the government down. But they haven't had any of those votes yet. And a reorganization of government is what could throw a wrench in the works of what these parties are trying to do.
Pressure on the government has also mounted in recent weeks after opponents called for the resignation of Prime Minister Elias El-Fakhakh over an alleged conflict of interest. How do you explain the turmoil in the Tunisian transition since the election of President Kais Saied?
Well, the president was elected with no political party and no political experience. So this kind of situation was likely, if not inevitable. He is a populist, but a relatively weak leader. And he's in a relatively weak constitutional position because it's a hybrid system, not a presidential system, where the speaker has as much, if not more, power than the president. But this is the context. What makes the turmoil is other factors, and that include the world economic crisis, which hit Tunisia hard, the pandemic, which is making the government focus on that instead of everything else. And the end of the political consensus did not begin with the 2019 election, but it started with the 2018 falling apart of the Carthage Pact, which had brought together Muslim, democratic, and secular forces into the inclusive government that had led Tunisia to winning the Nobel Prize in 2015. And that unity position, that inclusivity, fell apart in 2018. And now we have the result, this fractious parliament and an unhappy population voting for populists instead of the existing political parties, which they've been doing since the revolution. So the solution will be the evolution of political parties that develop both strong positions within parliament that can get things done and that move away from the ideological and partisan infighting that we see now, which keeps their base voting for them, but they don't get much done. And they'll have to get closer to what the population actually wants. And that's job creation, social services, human security.
So what are the possible scenarios for Tunisia in light of the latest developments, which are marred with exclusion?
Well, there's several scenarios. One is the prime minister might force members of the largest party, the Ennahda Party, out of the government coalition, which would please some of the members of the opposition and even some of the members of the ruling coalition. But that's an exercise in biting the hand that feeds you, those that put him into power. So that would not be sustainable. Now, the Speaker of the House could reorganize the government with the Prime Minister, but that doesn't address the fact that he has these issues of conflict of interest, of potential corruption, nor does it solve the problem of opposition to his own party. So it would be a stopgap solution that postpones the crisis. The more sustainable solution is to reorganize the government with a new Prime Minister, or to hasten the inquiry to determine the guilt or innocence of this Prime Minister in a way that's acceptable to the five parties, and then talk about a new government that includes the interests of the five parties. I think the Speaker of Parliament wins by being highly responsive, even if that responsiveness moves them back to what Tunisia went through in early 2020 when they were trying to organize a government and couldn't agree for months and months, because he's forcing the other political parties not to just agree on what they're against, but to actually argue over what they're for. And that puts him in a stronger position vis-a-vis all the smaller parties. The likely scenario is more legislative paralysis, but the sustainable solution would be legislative innovation and transparency and responsiveness to the general public. And we're not seeing that from any of the parties right now.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The world has made progress in fighting AIDS, but still faces challenges in meeting goals that were set for this year, a situation complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic. VOA's Lenok Mudu talks with Winnie Bianima, the executive director of UNAIDS, about the situation.
When I joined the organization at the end of last year, we were actually struggling to meet the targets for 2020 global HIV targets. But we were struggling. We could see that we will come to the middle of this year when we issue our annual report and find we are off target. And indeed, we are. But the COVID situation is threatening to blow us completely off course. What do I mean? Our report came out a week ago. We call it Seizing the Moment. But it showed tremendous progress over 10 years in reducing new infections, in putting people on treatment, even reducing deaths. But it showed that this success is not shared equally across the world. And therefore, we are not able to achieve global targets because there are many other parts that aren't moving fast enough. The good news is that sub-Saharan Africa is the most hit region with HIV, but it's the one that has made the fastest progress. For example, the whole world reduced in 10 years. The global average is 23%. But Africa managed to reduce it by 38%. South Africa alone, the worst hit country, reduced by 53%. A small country like South Africa made huge progress on putting people on treatment and keeping them on treatment. It hit the targets, which we call 90-90-90, and moved it to 95-90, went above the targets. So if it can do it, why can't the rest of the world? But then we saw through these results that some other regions, new infections are even rising, like Eastern Europe, Central Asia, rising by 72%, the same with Latin America. The big progress is here in Africa. And we have to understand that that's because of political commitment, putting resources there, and for that we have to thank development partners, particularly in the United States, the Europeans, and the Global Fund. It's also about empowering communities to be able to be at the center to fight for their lives. It's about respecting human rights. And yeah, it's about being focused on results.
What is causing the increase in one region and the reduction in sub-Saharan Africa, for example?
The epidemic is different in each region. In Eastern and Southern Africa, which are the two parts of Africa that are most hit, the epidemic is driven heterosexually, sex between men and women. There's also gay sex, and there's also sex workers as a very vulnerable group. So we find that there has been a lot of effort being put in to raise awareness for people to go for prevention, so men going for condoms, sticking to one partner, and that is often combined with putting people on treatment. Staying on treatment, then you can't infect when your viral load is suppressed. We also use voluntary medical male circumcision. That's another factor that helps to prevent. But the infections, the vulnerability of women and girls remains much higher than boys and men of the same age. There is a real concern, and that's driven by women and girls not having control of their own bodies and a culture that accepts violent masculinities, harmful masculinities. So there's a lot to do at the level of changing social norms, tackling attitudes and behaviors. In Eastern Europe, because the driver is mainly gay sex and people who inject drugs, the governments there have not paid attention to those groups in terms of giving them their rights, giving them the space to come forward for treatments. They remain underground and they remain unable to access prevention and treatment to stop this infection growing. That's the real reason.
That was Winnie Bianima, the executive director of UNAIDS, speaking with VOA's Lenok Dumudu. The U.S. administration has rescinded a rule that would have required international students to transfer schools or leave the country if their colleges hold classes entirely online this fall. The decision was announced at the start of a hearing in a federal lawsuit in Boston brought by Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The announcement brings relief to thousands of foreign students who had been at risk of being deported, along with hundreds of universities scrambling to reassess their plans for the fall. The International Organization for Migration says tens of thousands of Ethiopian migrants stranded in a war-torn Yemen are in fear of their lives as COVID-19 spreads throughout the country and life-saving aid is in short supply. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 1,460 cases of coronavirus, including 418 deaths, are reported in Yemen. But aid agencies believe the true number is much higher. As this deadly disease spreads widely throughout local communities, the UN Migration Agency warns thousands of Ethiopian migrants are at greater risk. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon says migrants are subject to forcible relocation, arbitrary detention and abuse, as well as fear of falling sick and dying from COVID-19, with little prospect of receiving treatment.
For nearly 6 years, Yemen has been an extremely unsafe place to be a migrant. COVID-19 has made this situation worse. Migrants are scapegoated as carriers of the virus and as a result suffer exclusion and violence. In addition to the forced removals, fears about COVID-19 have led to migrants in Yemen experience verbal and physical harassment, increased detention, and movement restrictions.
Yemen traditionally has been a country of transit for impoverished Ethiopians seeking work and a better life in Saudi Arabia. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrant arrivals in Yemen has decreased by 90% in recent months because of COVID-19 related restrictions. Dillon says most of the stranded Ethiopians are sleeping in the open or in unsafe abandoned buildings. That puts them at greater risk of exposure to COVID-19. He tells VOA access to the migrants has always been difficult in the conflict-ridden country. However, he notes COVID-19 is what he calls a new variable.
We need to ensure that our protocols and our responses to people in need follow strict safety guidelines in order to protect our staff, some of whom have become ill with COVID-19. Many of the people are in urban areas, seeking out new places to sleep every night, moving from place to place, and that can really challenge the ability to deliver support services to migrants.
IOM spokesman Dillon says the migrants lack basic services, including food, clean water, and health care. He says his agency's $155 million appeal to support more than 5.3 million people in Yemen this year is only half funded. If the needed funds are not received, he warns millions of displaced Yemenis and migrants will be left to face the devastating and worsening crisis by themselves. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.